The question is therefore narrowed down to the following point: granted that certain forms, apparently differing in sizes, colors, costumes, sex, and age, present themselves on the platform, they must be either 1. Deceptive personations by one man, or 2. The manifestations of an occult force. There is no escape from the syllogism. The battle must be fought out at that cabinet door. I realize this the first day I came, I realize it tenfold now. The weeks I spent there were weeks of as hard mental labor as I ever gave to any subject in my whole life. I passed through every degree of incredulity and distrust. I was ever on the watch lest I might miss some new circumstance calculated to overturn my formed opinion, and ever ready to confess myself a dupe of impostors if the fact could be demonstrated to me. But I finally reached the same point with Mr. Morrill that whatever might be thought of the cause of the phenomena, they were not due to charlatanry or prestidigitation. And yet better men than I have been deceived before, and how am I better entitled than they to the public confidence, for the stories I tell? Why should I expect sober-minded men and women to believe there is no fraud in all this, until they have the same opportunities as myself to see all and ponder on all? And how, especially, can I ask men of exact science, trained to accept nothing, absolutely nothing, without full and complete demonstration, mathematical demonstration? I do not, and, therefore, my office is to first tell my tale as clearly, succinctly, candidly as lies within my power, and let it carry conviction as far as it will, in its perfect integrity of statement. Chapter: Materialization. Unquestionably my first chapter about the materialization of spirit forms at Chittenden should be prefaced by some notice of the chronology of this phase of manifestation, but with the meager facilities at my command when the major part of this work was written, I can only glance at the subject. A sparsely settled rural district, far removed from libraries, is a bad place for the collection of historical data, so I must mainly rely upon my memory of many books read in the course of many years. If I were to refer to ancient times, I might easily cite a host of instances of the alleged reappearance of materialized spirits upon the scene of their pre-mortem activity. I have already alluded in former chapters to a few of the authors in whose writings the diligent student may satisfy his curiosity upon the subject. It suffices to repeat that the sacred writings of most nations, the classics, and the architectural remains of primitive races, afford proofs that the congenital aspirations of the human family for immortal existence have not gone hungry for lack of sustenance. 121. Our modern materialists may reason themselves into a comfortable reliance upon protoplasms and final molecules, and glibly set aside the claims of their opponents by endowing pure matter with the promise and potency of every form and quality of life. But, after all, as the London Times truly says, theology is apparently slain only to revive. Professor Tyndall does not solve, and it is obvious that his method cannot enable him to solve, the riddle of the universe. There is, too, another difficulty which he is the first to confess. His analysis of the world's history leaves out one half of man, and he finds it impossible to deny to this other side of man's nature a reality as absolute as that which he claims for his physical faculties and for his understanding. The strain of reason and the emotions of his spiritual nature will not rest unrecognized, and when the end of the professor's address is reached, we echo his own thought if we say, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in his philosophy." I venture to say, that of those who have given any serious thought to the subject, 50 persons would prefer to have my researches end in indubitable proof that the manifestations are genuine, to one who would like to have me discover fraud beneath the surface. Says Gizot, in his Meditations upon the Religious Questions of the Day, belief in the supernatural is a fact natural, primitive, universal, and constant in the life and history of the human race. Unbelief in the supernatural begets materialism, materialism sensuality, sensuality social convulsions, amid whose storms man again learns to believe and pray. The great address of Tyndall at Belfast opened with the following majestic prelude, An impulse inherent in primeval man turned his thoughts and questionings betimes toward the sources of natural phenomena. The same impulse inherited and intensified is the spur of scientific action today, determined by it. By a process of abstraction from experience, we form physical theories which lie beyond the pale of experience, but which satisfy the desire of the mind to see every natural occurrence resting upon a cause. In forming their notions of the origin of things, our earliest historic, and, doubtless, we might add, our prehistoric, ancestors pursued, as far as their intelligence permitted, the same course. They also fell back upon experience, but with this difference that the particular experiences which furnished the weft and woof of their theories, were drawn, not from the study of nature, but from what lay much closer to them, the observation of men. Their theories accordingly took an anthropomorphic form. To supersensual beings, which, however potent and invisible, were nothing but species of human creatures, perhaps raised from among mankind, and retaining all human passions and appetites, were handed over the rule and governance of natural phenomena. Tested by observation and reflection, these early notions failed in the iron run to satisfy the more penetrating intellects of our race. Far in the depths of history we find men of exceptional power differentiating themselves from the crowd, rejecting these anthropomorphic notion, and seeking to connect natural phenomena with their physical principles. But long prior to these purer efforts of the understanding, the merchant had been abroad, and rendered the philosopher possible. Commerce had been developed, wealth amassed, leisure for travel and for speculation secured, while races educated under different conditions, and therefore differently informed and endowed, had been stimulated and sharpened by mutual contact. In those regions where the commercial aristocracy of ancient Greece mingled with its eastern neighbors, the sciences were born, being nurtured and developed by free-thinking and courageous men. The state of things to be displaced may be gathered from a passage of Euripides quoted by Hume: "There is nothing in the world, no glory, no prosperity. The gods toss all into confusion, mix everything with its reverse, that all of us, from our ignorance and uncertainty, may pay them the more worship and reverence." Now, as science demands the radical extirpation of caprice and the absolute reliance upon law in nature, there grew with the growth of scientific notion a desire and determination to sweep from the field of theory this mob of gods and demons, and to place natural phenomena on a basis more congruent with themselves. The problem which had been previously approached from above was now attacked from below. Theoretic effort passed from the super to the subsensible. It was felt that to construct the universe in idea, it was necessary to have some notion of its constituent parts, of what Lucretius subsequently called the first beginnings. Abstracting again from experience, the leaders of scientific speculation reached at length the pregnant doctrine of atoms and molecule, the latest developments of which were set forth with such power and clearness at the last meeting of the British Association. But, if I may humbly criticize one of so lofty an intellect, it appears to me that the course of scientific inquiry has led our modern philosophers too far towards the opposite extreme from that of Euripides. To disabuse the world of the notion that the powers of nature are not subject to the domination of gods and demons, which was a common belief so late as the 17th century, and upon which the persecutions for witchcraft were based, it is not necessary to deny the existence of these invisible beings to whom the ancients applied the terms quoted, but whom we classify as developed and undeveloped spirits. To prove the potentiality of the ultimate of matter, it is not necessary that we should ignore the existence of spirit. To demonstrate the organic and inorganic constituents of the human body does not involve the denial of the existence of the soul. If Tyndall and his associates would but once admit that there may be forms of matter and essences so subtle as to escape the test of their crucibles and scales, they would be at a point whence a whole new universe of research would open before them, inviting them to reach out for richer rewards of fame than ever before repaid the study and labor of philosopher or chemist. In looking back to the early days of American history, I cannot now recall any stories of materialization prior to the close of the 17th century, when the storm of fanaticism arose that cost many worthy people their lives on the charge of witchcraft. In Mr. Upham's History of Salem Witchcraft will be found many instances of persons being taken hold of by visible supernatural forms, of persons being sat upon by specters while lying in their beds, of animals suddenly entering rooms in a mysterious manner and as suddenly disappearing, to say nothing of levitations, such as that of Margaret Rule, rappings, the throwing about of heavy articles, and the hearing of spirit voices by many witnesses. True, Mr. Upham ascribes the whole thing to trickery, assuming that by practice, acquired in the course of a single winter with the help of a half-breed Barbados slave woman, a few ignorant girls had become wonderful adepts in the art of jugglery, and probably of ventriloquism. But does this explanation satisfy any really candid inquirer? Especially, does it satisfy any person who, in the presence of our modern mediums, has seen the same things repeated? It was the prevalent belief among the learned of all professions, at the epoch in question, that the North American Indians had migrated hither, by way of Bering's Straits, under a compact with the devil to transfer allegiance from God to him, receiving in return certain occult powers, by which they were enabled, not only to injure their fellow men, but also exercise more or less control over the elements. Witches were persons who had entered into a secret treaty with the evil one through his allies, the Indians, and gotten Mather, Sam, Paris, and other theologians of influence in the infant colony inculcated the doctrine that the execution of these unfortunates would find favor in the sight of God, and proportionately distress and cripple the power of the arch enemy of mankind. The Salem witchcraft tragedies were followed by such a reaction that tardy justice was done to the families of the victims of the popular frenzy, and nothing was said about supernaturalism, at least nothing, I think, that aroused general interest until the present dispensation was ushered in at the little cabin of Michael Weakman, in 1847, where, in the family of John D. Fox, its then lessee, there bubbled up the tiny spring that is now so great a river. The raps and poundings which will always be known as the Rochester knockings and forever perpetuate the memory of Kate and Margaret Fox, were followed by many other and more wonderful forms of manifestation, such as the lifting of heavy bodies, the phenomenal increase and diminution of their normal weight, the lightest articles acquiring marvelous ponderosity and the heaviest equally notable levity, the ringing of bells, the playing by unseen performers on instruments, and, finally, by the materialization of spirit hands, faces, and full forms. At the same time, however, that these things were going on and the attention of the civilized world was arrested by them, similar phenomena were happening in other private families. The Davenports, of Buffalo, N.Y., were having some slight premonitions of the future career they were destined for, but the physical manifestations did not occur in their presence until February 1855, a year before this. The Coons family, of Athens County, Ohio, had instrumental and vocal concerts by the spirits, and materialized bands wrote communications. 126, but the Eds tell me that they had been seeing materialized spirit forms from their childhood, and their mother before them, and, in the absence of conflicting evidence, I suppose that the credit will have to be awarded to them of witnessing the first instances of this highest form of physical manifestation, occurring in our time. And yet, notwithstanding this fact, and the additional one, that no family so gifted in these rare psychological traits is to be found in history, their names are not even mentioned in Ipse Sargent's Planchette, one of the most scholarly works on spiritualism in our language. It should be remarked, however, in explanation of this fact, that Mr. Sargent informs me that he applied to the Eds for permission to visit their home, and was refused by Horatio, who probably answered his letter in haste, not recognizing the name as that of so able an author and so enlightened a spiritualist. One evening, in March 1872, the Eddy family were sitting about the fire, when an event occurred that ushered in the series of materializations that have culminated in the public séances now given nightly. William had cut his foot very badly with an axe, and was confined to his bed in an adjoining room. Suddenly, without warning, The grandmother's spirit in full materialized form appeared at the threshold, and gave instruction for some salves to apply to the wound, and a cooling draught to abate the fever that had set in, after which she disappeared. Shortly after this, when Delia Eddy was engaged in reducing some maple sugar over the kitchen fire, the spirit of a man of short stature suddenly materialized himself, frightening her, so that she dropped a pan of sugar she was carrying. The spirits then told the family that William was to be developed as the greatest medium of the age, and that he must no longer sit for the instrument playing exhibitions, as he had been doing for a number of years, but must go into the cabinet or closet alone and take no bells or instruments with him. These instructions being obeyed, spirit faces soon began to appear, and finally Santum, the giant Winnebago chief, whom my readers will recollect my mentioning in connection with a séance at Honto's cave, stalked out in full form. For a long while no other spirit came, but finally they made their appearance. Electa, a light-complexioned squaw, about 17 years of age, who always brings her pet robin with her, and who forms one of the spirit band who perform instrumental music at the dark circles, many of which I have attended, and which will be described in due time, was among the earliest visitors. Then the deceased members of their own family appeared among them. Miranda, who came hand in hand with a young man, named Griffin Grin, to whom she had been betrothed. The lovers, parted for a while by death, were reunited beyond the grave. Francis and James, their deceased brothers, came too. Then, as people began to flock to the old farmhouse, their personal friends manifested their presence, the first, or nearly the first, for the family cannot definitely decide the point, being a Mrs. Annie Barker, wife of G. Barker, of Habbleton, VT. One evening, a young lady visitor saw the shade of her father, the late Captain Johnson, United States Navy, who came in citizen's clothes. The daughter mentally requested him to appear to her in his uniform, whereupon he retired for a moment and then returned in full naval dress, with sword and epaulettes. This is one instance among many of the doing of something by the apparitions in response to mental requests made by spectators. The thing has occurred to me several times, as will be seen further on. It should also be noted that this supposed spirit reappeared in the uniform of his rank, and it is hardly credible that William Eddy, in addition to all the other costumes uninformed skeptics imagine his wardrobe to contain, should have a full assortment of army and navy uniforms, for officers and privates. What tender memories in many minds cling about this rude apartment, where so many can say, ere the evening lamps are lighted, and, like phantoms grim and tall, shadows from the fitful firelight dance upon the parlor wall, then the forms of the departed enter at the open door, the beloved, the true-hearted, come to visit me once more. 129, Chapter 9, The First Séance. The now famous Circle Room was built last December, and opened to the public on the evening of January 1, 1874, on which occasion the exercises began with a dark circle, at which the spirit, or what is claimed to be the spirit, of a sailor, named George Dix, made a lengthy dedicatory address. He declared, among other things, that the apartment was to be used solely for spiritual séances, with the occasional exception of a quiet dance. After the dark circle, one of the usual kind for materializing was held, and addresses and prayers were spoken by the spirits of Mrs. Eddy, Mrs. Eaton, an old lady from New York State, who made her first appearance here in October 1872, during her granddaughter's visit, and has acted as assistant directress of séances ever since, a Mrs. Wheeler, late of Utica. Dr. Horton, also late of Utica, who brought his two baby children in his arms and addressed his widow, and the elder of these two children, little Minna, who spoke some words of comfort to her weeping mother. Since that eventful evening, William has held a materialization circle every evening, Sundays excepted, a circumstance that, in view of the usual serious exhaustion felt by mediums, is very remarkable. Mr. Dot Crooks says of David Hume, the famous medium, that the psychic force by which the phenomena are produced, is attended by an expenditure of his vital force or nervous energy, proportionate to the degree of its activity of manifestation. Its flow through Mr. Holmes' system varies enormously, says Mr. Crookes, not only from week to week, but from hour to hour. On some occasions the force is inappreciable by my tests for an hour or more, and then suddenly reappears in great strength. He testifies to witnessing the painful state of nervous and bodily prostration in which some of these experiments have left Mr. Holmes, to seeing him lying in an almost fainting condition on the floor, pale and speechless. And yet I, myself, having attended at about 50 of William Eddy's materializations, can certify that, beyond a slight appearance of fatigue immediately after emerging from the cabinet, he seems as well as usual. He goes about his daily avocations, takes no rest to speak of, says he has eaten nothing for weeks but a little fruit, and yet, after as many as 18 ghosts have appeared in a single evening, his pulse is regular, and he resumes the pipe that he laid down at the moment of entering the circle room. If his materializations were nothing but trickery, this might easily be accounted for, but I have satisfied myself, and hope to satisfy the public beyond reasonable doubt, that this is not the case. A pseudo-scientist has recently spent one evening here, and is getting ready to publish in a book his conviction that both I and the hundreds of other lay spectators have been deceived. Has spent one evening, I say, and nevertheless writes me that he is convinced, and requires no more evidence to convince the scientific world, that it is all fraud. How different from the late Professor Hare, who devoted years to the subject of spiritual intercourse, and did not give his adherence to the doctrine until he had completed a long series of scientific tests and experiments, and from Mr. Crookes, one of the first scientific men in Great Britain, who spent 3 years in the inquiry before he avowed himself satisfied. I reached Chittenden on my present mission, September 17, 1874, and attended a circle the same evening. Outside a violent gale of wind was blowing, the clouds hung low, the rain fell, and the atmospheric conditions would in almost any other locality have been considered unfavorable. A company of 25 persons assembled in the circle room, among them several who, like myself, had arrived that day. Shortly after 7 o'clock William entered the cabinet, and we waited expectantly for our weird visitors. To promote harmony of feeling among the persons present, vocal and instrumental music was resorted to, continuity of sound and rapidity of time seeming to be more necessary than quality of execution. I will say here that I have failed to get from spiritualists any very satisfactory explanation of the part that music plays in these manifestations, and for lack of a better will suggest one of my own. Presupposing that there is such a thing in the human system as the force systemed magnetic, sometimes odic, and more recently psychic, which has its polarites, its positive and negative qualities, and that persons may be classed among the positives and negatives respectively, the effect of music, by concentrating attention upon itself, is to reduce the positives to passivity, and by nervous stimulation exalt the negatives to something of an equality of condition with their more forceful neighbors. The result is equilibrium between the two extremes, and consequent receptivity. Then, going so far as to concede that there are such things as spirits, and that they can exert an appreciable magnetic, odic, psychic, or whatever we choose to call it, influence upon us, it is not difficult to see that they are placed in such a positive attitude towards their medium and his circle, as to enable them to force their power upon us to the degree of producing the several phases of manifestations. The logician will say, that much is taken for granted in this proposition, and so I will leave him to first note the features of these phenomena wherever occurring, and then at his leisure construct a better theory than mine. So much for the psychological aspect of the case. And to this extent some enlightened spiritualists precede me. But why should the spirits demand quick tunes, jigs, waltzes, reels, and compositions of like character, in which the constant repetition of the same notes occurs in presto or prestissimo measure? May the answer not be suggested by two of Professor Tyndall's lectures at the Royal Institution, in one of which be demonstrated that a ray of light was allowed to traverse a strip of glass every time he caused it to set up a musical sound, the glass being held in a vise, and the light from an electric lamp polarized upon it, and in the other, upon the rhythm of flames, in which he showed that a flame 20 inches in height would fall down to 8 on the slightest tap on an anvil. It responded to the tinkle of a bunch of keys or a few pence shaken together, the creaking of boots, the rustling of a silk dress or a piece of paper, while certain intonations of the voice threw it into violent commotion. Oops, Sergeant's Planchet, p. 379. If we put ourselves for the purposes of this inquiry into the position of the spiritualists, we might reasonably demand that men of science, investigating the subject, should not overlook the fact that much light may be gained upon the nature and properties of this new occult force by experiments in this direction. I have heard this call for rapid music so often made that I have come to the conclusion that equal, constant, and rapid vibrations of the atmosphere play an important part in the production of the phenomenon of materialization. I am also satisfied that careful experiments in the matter of the intensity and quality of the light used would result in unexpected and great discoveries. May it not be that the yellow ray bears some such relation to spirit materializations as it does to photography? Dr. H. T. Child, of Philadelphia, writes me that, while he thinks that if we understood this law, the materializations might be better, in his opinion it is more important to have a good medium and good circle. He has known instances where a circle containing rude and uncongenial persons got nothing satisfactory, while one following it, on the same evening, obtained everything that could be desired. 134. We had not sat many minutes in our first circle before a voice, the piping treble of an old woman, addressed to us some remarks from behind the curtain that hung over the open door of the cabinet, to the effect that this was a bad night for manifestations, and none but the strongest spirits could show themselves. I may as well at once admit that this voice had such peculiarities of accent and provincial expressions as to excite the suspicion that it was William speaking in falsetto. So I crossed that off in my notebook as a fact of no value to the spiritualists. But since then, having seen the woman herself, Mrs. Eaton, and heard her address me personally from a distance of not more than 10 feet, in the self-same voice, I re-entered the fact and transcribe it here. The curtain presently stirred, and the Indian woman named Honto stepped on the platform. She appears young, dark-complexioned, of marked Indian features, lithe and springy in movement, full of fun, natural in manner, and full of inquisitiveness. She measures 5 feet 3 inches in height, against a painted scale I had placed beside the cabinet door. To William Eddy she bears not the slightest resemblance in any particular, all assertions of any superficial observer to the contrary notwithstanding. I have seen her about 30 times, and have necessarily enjoyed ample opportunities to compare her with William in every particular. Nevertheless, the first 2 times I saw her, I was so deceived by the dull light as to fancy her the same as William in height and bulk. In this circle room, one's eye must be educated, as it must at sea, to judge of distances, or in a mountainous region, to estimate the height and distance of the various peaks. Let any one try even so simple an experiment as to judge how high a man's hat will come against the wall when set upon the floor, and some idea will be attained of the optical difficulties to be overcome before one can form a correct impression of the relative heights of the spirits who present themselves. She changes her dress frequently, sometimes appearing in a dark skirt with light overdress, shaped like the garment called a polonaise, sometimes with these shades reversed, sometimes with light clothing throughout and a sash around her waist, or bands crossed over her bosom, sometimes with a cap, and at others bareheaded, sometimes with her black hair a yard or more in length, flowing over her shoulders, and again with it braided in a single rope down her back. A remarkable fact is, that at times her hair is very long, and at others not longer than the artist has represented it in the picture. I have seen her with what seemed to be buckskin leggings, and a short dress reaching a little below the knee, and again, with high moccasins trimmed about the top with what looked like fur. Others tell me that they have seen her in a dress upon which were 2 rows of phosphorescent buttons gleaming in the obscure light like great diamonds, that ran from each shoulder in curved lines to the bottom of her skirt, but I have not seen the costume myself. The sketch represents one of the phenomena attending the appearance of this spirit girl, and is what I witnessed on the evening in question. Honto steps either to the wall or to one of the two persons, Mrs. R. Cleveland and Mr. E. V. Pritchard, of Albany, N. Y. who usually occupy chairs on the platform, and suddenly produces a knitted shawl or a long piece of gauzy fabric, apparently from the air itself, and exhibits it to the audience.